From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe joins us with stories of high strangeness, followed in the last hour with conversations with Linda. Here is what's happening. Well, this story about Sony getting hacked gets stranger by the minute. With a number of theater chains defecting en masse, Sony Pictures has pulled a planned Christmas Day release of the movie The Interview. U.S. officials have reportedly linked a massive cyber attack against Sony to North Korea, which is the center of the Seth Rogen, James Franco comedy. In announcing this decision to cancel the holiday debut, Sony also hit back at the hackers who threaten movie theaters and moviegoers and who have terrorized the studio and its employees for weeks. The Interview centers on a hapless television host who is recruited to assassinate a North Korean dictator, Kim Jong-un. The country has condemned the film, and some cybersecurity experts believe that it played a role in the hacking attack on the studio. Now, of course, North Korea has denied any involvement in the attacks. But who's an expert on cyber war? Charles R. Smith. And we got to get his take on this one. What a story, Charles. Well, welcome. What do you think's going on?
Well, I think it's fairly obvious that both Sony and North Korea have the bomb. In the case of Seth Rogen's film, it's a $200 million flop, which now is going to be a great success utilizing this publicity by pulling it from its debut. Seriously speaking, the Sony decision, of course, has been derided by a number of people. I think it's an excellent publicity move because obviously not many people would have gone to see it anyway.
That's true.
The fact is, of course, is that Sony is now learning very quickly what the word encryption means, because if they had actually provided strong encryption on their computers and servers, they wouldn't have this problem to begin with.
It's going to make a number of companies wake up, Charles. So do you think the movie The Interview eventually is going to get released?
Oh, absolutely. These guys are they're no dummies, and I'm not talking about the North Koreans. I'm referring to the Sony executives.
Right.
They know full well that bad news is good news, especially when it comes to a movie such as this. To be absolutely honest with you, again, it's a stinker, okay? Not that many people would have gone to see it, and Sony has forked out about $200 million to put together what is, you know, a fairly thin comedy. Well, now everybody is going to want to see it. Why is Kim Jong-un so upset?
Upset, yeah. You're right. They couldn't buy this publicity.
Something like this.
They could not buy this kind of publicity. As far as North Korea and their ability to hack, like you said, had they had Sony had encryption equipment set up on their computer systems, they may have stopped this. But how good are the North Koreans, Charles, with hacking?
They're fairly good. They're not exactly top of the line, but they are fairly good at what they're doing. They've done this before. This is the reason why, you know, newsflash, the federal government came out, well, is it today, going, we think it's the North Koreans. The hack attempt and success at this is very similar to a hack attack against several South Korean firms that occurred last year. You know, clearly these guys are utilizing cyber warfare or information warfare as a technique to get some things done. They're not dumb. Again, they're not number one. The Israelis, the Germans, the Russians are much, much better.
They sure are. You can track Charles' website, softwar.net. He does a great job. Well, 'tis the season, right? A Florida thief faked a heart attack inside a Walmart store so that his male accomplice could walk out of the store with a shopping cart stuffed with toys, including a motorized Barbie power wheel. Now, while the diversion proved initially successful, as people kind of flocked around the guy as he was faking his heart attack, and his buddy was being pushing the cart out. You could clearly see this on video. Well, they got arrested on grand theft charges because, we're, you know, crime doesn't pay when you have surveillance footage, and they probably got, they have this facial recognition. And so they got them. They got them. Russia, by the way, has warned the United States not to provide lethal military equipment to Ukrainian forces fighting pro-Russia rebels in the country's east. A U.S. official suggested that Washington should consider providing the aid. President Barack Obama expected to sign a bill soon that would provide up to $350 million worth of military aid to support the Ukrainian Army forces in its fight against Russian-backed separatists. But how much can you continue to push Russia? The sinking oil prices? Everything like this is beginning to get to Vladimir Putin. In a moment, Stephen Cohen joins me. We'll be talking about Russia and are we pushing Russia into a war with us. Well, they say it will take about 11 trillion gallons of water to recover from California's continuing drought. 11 trillion gallons. That according to new analysis of NASA satellite data. And the Green Climate Fund, which is a United Nations affiliated piggy bank intended to finance climate change projects around the world, is determined to win sweeping UN-style immunities from prosecutions for its global operations, even though the U.S., its biggest contributor, opposes that idea. And the U.N. itself says its own diplomatic immunities can't cover the outfit. Well, let's check in, of course, with renowned environmental consultant Dr. Timothy Ball. Tim, why would they even want immunity? What's going on here?
Well, one of the things that they've done all along, they tried to get immunity for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And, of course, the reason is because they don't want to be held liable for all the damage that these things are doing. So they just want to put themselves above the law. It's just that simple. And the UN do this all the time. They just operate with impunity, and I don't know how much longer people are going to put up with it.
That's a good point. Tim, thank you so much. You have yourself a great Christmas. A cemetery containing more than a million mummified human bodies has been unearthed in central Egypt, according to archaeologists. What a great discovery there. And it's time, of course, for our update from Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Peter, what's in the skies these days?
Well, good evening, George, and greetings to all our audience members tonight. I'd like to start with a couple brief administrative points. We're getting a lot of reports of the star Sirius that comes up over the southeastern sky early in the evening at this time of year. And I'd like to invite a lot of our audience to go out when they have a clear sky in their area and take a look at that beautiful star, brightest star in the heavens, just to the left of and below Orion. I'm trying to stop as many of those reports as I can. Each one takes a lot of my time.
Mm-hmm.
Also, a lot of people are calling and asking whether we're interested in past sighting reports. That's an issue that I've talked about on the program before, months ago, I think it was, and we are very interested in past sighting reports. And that leads me to my first two reports tonight. We got a very nice report from a gentleman who is a former military officer. He's a physician and he's a pilot. He's submitted a report about a sighting he had. He believes it was August 20 of 1964. He was a lad of 14 years of age before he went into the military. And he was out in the middle of a field in New Jersey, on the coast of New Jersey, saw a very bright light come streaking towards him, covered a third of the sky, he estimates, in about 3 seconds or so. And it suddenly started doing very sharp right-angle turns without slowing down. Very interesting report. He says, and I hear this line often from a lot of people who report to us, it's as clear in his mind's eye today as it was back 50 years ago. Very interesting report that's posted to our website. Also, a very interesting report from Birchwood, Alaska, December 21st, 1995. Group of men were out shooting skeet. They were on a skeet field shooting clay targets, and they saw an object coming at them. At first, they thought it was a meteor, but then they realized that the fire was going out the back of it. Meteors usually burn the front of it as it comes into the atmosphere. And they stood there for 6 or 7 minutes enthralled by this object as it went over their heads. 10 days ago, Plymouth, Minnesota, a gentleman was driving to work at 04:55 hours in the morning. Suddenly, the foggy sky, almost solid fog above him, lit up a bright cobalt blue and remained illuminated, brightly illuminated, for he estimates about 12 minutes, or 12 seconds, I should have said. And he has a brother who is in Shakopee, Minnesota.
Minnesota, yeah, I've been there.
It's on the, I think, the west side of Minneapolis. And he saw it from 16 miles away. What it was, we'll probably never know. Last report, got a very interesting report tonight from a gentleman who's a truck driver. He was driving at about 9:30 tonight in Bangor, Maine. And this is 4 hours ago, George. And he likes to look at the night sky. And he was looking out his side driver's window, and he saw a boomerang-shaped object hovering just at the base of solid fog. And it had tiny lights on the leading edge of it. Suddenly, it just accelerated vertically, went into the fog, and disappeared from his sight. So a lot's going on, and I hope the Coast listeners, if they see something unusual, will consider submitting it to the National UFO Reporting Center.
The website, ufocenter.com. Peter, thank you. You have a Merry Christmas if we don't talk to you next week, but I think we probably will. In a moment, of course, Stephen Cohen joins us. We're going to talk about Russia. How bad is that situation? And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. This hour I felt was so important to talk about this tension that's happening between Russia. And mark my words, this decision to begin to kind of open up the channels with Cuba is also based on, I think, slapping Russia in the face. Stephen Cohen is a professor of Russian studies and history emeritus at NYU, professor of politics emeritus at Princeton University. He is a distinguished scholar of Russian history, and it's very important to bring him in to talk with him about this. Something's happening, Stephen. It's good to have you back, but I sense some tension here. What can you tell us?
Two words. Three words, new Cold War. There's no doubt about it. I ought to say, in fairness to your so many listeners, because the last time I was on, I guess it was back in April.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got so much mail, more mail, email, regular mail, than I've ever gotten before. So congratulations to you. But I should say, in all fairness, you call me distinguished, and I guess if you look at my vita, my resume, it looks distinguished.
It does.
But since February, I've written a series of articles, I think four, in The Nation magazine. If anybody's interested, they can go to thenation.com. The last one was called Patriotic Heresy Against the New Cold War. It turns out I'm a patriotic heretic.
Oh, really?
These articles have brought down on me, personally, an avalanche of, I consider it slander, but let it go. But people call me a Putin apologist and a person who's taken Russian side. But I was raised in Kentucky. On the adage, there's two sides to every story. And I think every one of your listeners will admit that they haven't heard the Russian side of the story. Now, if Russia has a little bit of the story on its side, just a little bit, we need to hear it, because that's the way you reach a negotiation.
Yes.
Each side tells his or her side of the story, and then you hear something that you agree upon, and that's where the negotiations begin. When I was on with you last time, I said that we were approaching the worst American-Russian confrontation since the missile Cuban missile crisis. Now, not all your folks are old enough to remember, but you and I remember.
Yep.
That it was considered at that moment there might be a nuclear war between the United States and Soviet Russia. And there wasn't. And there was leadership that got us out of that confrontation. Here's what I think happened. It's been just about a year. This story began in November in Kiev, Ukraine, November 2013. There was a political dispute of whether Ukraine should sign a trade agreement with Europe. The president decided against. He was elected. He wasn't a good guy, but he was fairly elected. People came into the street, and by February, he was overthrown. And a government came to power on a kind of street coup. The United States and Europe backed that new government, still the government of Kiev. Russia did not. Eastern Ukraine, which is more pro-Russian because it's more ethnically Russian, began to break away and seek Russia's protection. The political dispute became a civil war in Ukraine. The civil war became a proxy war, with the United States backing Kiev, Russia backing the eastern provinces. The proxy war led us into a new Cold War. And now, if you just look at what the Congress did, our Congress, last week, it passed two bills, two resolutions, which Obama has said he will sign, or he may have signed them already. The White House isn't clear about this. They are, to strip them down, declarations not only of Cold War against Russia, but hot war, because they encourage, they literally say, that Kiev should rearm itself and go to war against its eastern provinces, knowing full well that will bring Russia in big time. So I just ask you hypothetically, if Russia enters eastern Ukraine, I mean a real invasion, guys dropping from the sky, Russia shuts down communications in Kiev,
missiles flying,
tanks roll across the border, will America, NATO, enter western Ukraine? In which case, we're at war with Russia. That's where we are tonight, today.
And what scares me, Stephen, and concerns me, since 1962, when we had the Cuban Missile Crisis, I was 12 years old. I remember in school, we would do drills as if we were getting attacked, and we would hide in certain spots in the school. And, you know, we were petrified as little kids. Our neighbor, who lived right next door to where my mother still lives, built a fallout shelter in his basement. The Twilight Zone did an incredible story called The Shelter about a neighborhood that went crazy when they thought there was going to be a missile attack from Russia, from the Soviet Union, and their neighbor who had a fallout shelter would not let them in. It was an incredible time period, and I'm beginning to sense that with the problems Russia is having financially, the ruble dropping, the oil prices, this new relationship that's going to brew with Cuba, I think Putin's going to say enough is enough. This is my guess. What can you tell us there?
Well, I disagree with you a little bit about Cuba. I know a little. I'm not a Cuba expert, but I was there for the first time about 18 months ago, and I have a kind of scholarly interest in it for a reason I'll tell you in a minute.
Okay.
I remember, and I think you and I might have talked about this, that when I was a kid, they taught us at school to get under our desks to protect ourselves against a nuclear attack. I mean, what were they thinking?
That's really going to help us.
Yeah, I mean, we lived through, I mean, I always liked that movie. What was it, that film, Dr. Strangelove?
Yes, I mean, classic.
Everybody ought to try to see. And there was another one that was very funny called The Russians Are Coming. But those were Cold War films, but you could show them today. Here's the problem, in my mind. I'm what they call a senior citizen. And the only advantage of getting old is you have a memory of times past.
That's right.
And when history repeats itself, you can speak with some firsthand authority. In the 1970s, when I entered the debate in the United States over Cold War, there were very famous, very prominent figures on both sides. I mean senators, I mean movie stars, I mean professors and presidents of universities, having an argument about whether things had gotten out of control and we shouldn't try to wind down the Cold War. It was called détente, winding down the Cold War. The problem is today, it's only one hand clapping. That I'm on your broadcast saying to you and your listeners that based on my 40 years of scholarly study of Russia and America, that the story, the full story of how we got into this mess in Ukraine is not being told in the major newspapers. And let's name names. The New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, any of the cable stations, TV, any of the talk shows, it's simply a drumbeat of Washington's point of view. First of all, that's not democracy. Both sides should be heard. Second of all, that's how you get in war. Even when we had the debate over whether we should invade Iraq, not so long ago. You remember.
I
and
do.
Later everybody said it had been a big mistake. But nonetheless, there was a debate.
Hold on for a second, Stephen. We're going to take this quick break. We're going to come right back. We'll talk at this point. We'll also talk a little bit about Cuba, and we'll take some phone calls with you on Coast to Coast AM. Well, the powers that be would love for you to watch our television show, Beyond Belief. It is internet-based, but it plays on your flat screen, wherever you have internet capabilities. And what they'd like to do is offer you a promotion that you're going to love. For 99 cents, you get 30 days to watch Beyond Belief. You can sign up for the trial period right now at beyondbelief.com, www.beyondbelief.com. 99 cents for a 30-day trial period. Hey, you can't go wrong with that. Back in a moment. And welcome back to Coast, back with Stephen Cohen. We'll take your calls as well. So, Stephen, this Ukraine Freedom Support Act, which can last up to 3 years, and as you mentioned, provides military aid as well as everything else, weapons, defensive services. If this kicks in and we truly provide these arms, what do you think Russia is going to do?
We need to take one step back. There are reports, a lot of reports, that we, meaning the United States, NATO, and our allies, have already been supplying Kiev surreptitiously with a considerable number of weapons. There are reports, for example, that 3 airfields in Ukraine were shut down earlier this week, and people in the area saw military equipment on foreign aircraft being unloaded. Are these reports true? I don't know, but they're plausible. Secondly, Obama has to sign these congressional bills because they were passed almost unanimously. Therefore, he can't veto them. His veto would be overturned.
Right.
But the bills do not compel him to do anything. They just authorize him to do it if he so wishes.
It's almost like a referendum.
Well, it sounds like nobody wants full responsibility, while the Congress does what it usually does is, well, I don't know, not usually. But when it comes to Russia, it takes a deep breath, blows out a lot of hot air that's dangerous, and then the country's stuck with it. We've passed legislation against Russia, Soviet Russia, over the years, which is easy to pass and almost impossible to get rid of. So who knows how long this legislation will be on the books. But here, let me give you an example so your folks know what to look for.
Okay.
According to Secretary of State Kerry, if Russia will defend and protect the ceasefire in eastern Ukraine, that is between the Ukrainian rebels, which Russia backs, and the Ukrainian government in Kiev, which Washington backs, if Putin will do everything he can to protect that ceasefire, the United States might end its sanctions. Well, that sounds promising, right? It sounds like they've got something to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
But these bills passed by Congress urge Kiev to resume the war. That is to violate the ceasefire.
Right.
So you've got the executive branch of the American government saying, let's protect the ceasefire and try to get out of this crisis before it gets worse. And you have the Congress telling the President of the United States, I mean, telling Kiev, the government of Ukraine, no, you should revoke the ceasefire and attack. That's the kind of situation. I mean, is it the tail wagging the dog? I don't know. But let's go to your question. I'll repeat what I said. If Kiev launched an all-out attack on Russian-speaking citizens of Kiev, in the East, Putin cannot, because of his own domestic political situation and probably his own understanding of the international situation, do anything but intervene on the side of eastern Ukraine. And at that point, that's a tripwire. If Russia comes in really, not just surreptitiously, but with a real invasion, then the pressure on Obama, on the French, on the British, on NATO, mm-hmm. on the European Union, to send Western forces into Ukraine, then we are at the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yes, we are.
That's it. I mean, that's where we stand today. I mean, we're not there, and there's an easy way out. But if we get there, and by the way, in all the years that we waged a Cold War against the Soviet Union, 45, we never actually went to war against the Soviet Union. We never
shot each other.
We're close to shooting each other, and this isn't communist Russia. What in the world is going on?
It may be more tense now than it was back in 1962.
Well, you know what? You know what? You know what? I mean, I heard General Wesley Clark, not my favorite public official, say on TV the other day that Putin was the worst and most dangerous Russian leader since Stalin. Well, we were taught that those communist leaders were really bad, but Putin is worse. I mean, how did we get to the point where that's the way we see Putin in Russia today? Worse than communist Russia? When only 23 years ago in 1991, we were saying, oh, this is great. Communism is gone. We're going to be friends with Russia. What happened? Did they change? Did we change? This is a big question.
Sure is. Let's take a few calls, and I want to talk with you, Stephen, about Cuba and also about falling oil prices, seeing if that's a squeeze on Russia. Let's go to Jay in Irondale, Alabama, to get us started. Jay, you're on with Stephen Cohen. Go ahead.
Greetings. In Russian, you say Stulnovova. When I get up in the morning, that means what's new. I never know what I'm going to see. And I believe what we're seeing is a chess game going on here, and I believe biblical prophecy is taking place. There's no denying it. I've talked to people, since I speak a little bit of Russian, we have people, Russian-speaking people who live around here and everywhere in this country now. They wanted to get away, and they say it's getting more and more like it was over there. But this is nothing surprises me. I take one day at a time, and thank you for your show. До свидания, comrades.
Well, if I'd been able to back and forth with him from Alabama, I would have asked him how things look for the University of Alabama in the SEC basketball competition, because my team, Kentucky, is undefeated. But he wants to talk about the Bible in Russia. Religion, by the way, plays a very, very important role in Russia. The church, the Russian Orthodox Church, is solidly behind Putin. Some people think this is not a good thing. Other people think that this is the authentic Russia. That's why Putin's public opinion approval polls remain in the 80%. Can you imagine, George, 80%? You can't get 80% for anything in this country.
No.
You can't get 80% for Mother's Day. So some people think that this upsurge of religious nationalism, let's call it, that the church and the Kremlin have collaborated in, is part of the reason why Putin feels so confident at home. Just to sort of add a footnote to what your caller said, my own teacher, Professor Robert C. Tucker, he died a few years ago in his 90s, probably the greatest Russian authority in America of his generation, always used to say to his students, when it comes to Russia, never say never. And that is a very good cautionary note.
Do you like Putin?
It's not my job to like other leaders. I'll be really honest, full disclosure. I got to know Gorbachev in 1987. And when he fell from power, we became members, my wife and I became members of his extended family. And he's had a lot of personal tragedies. His beloved wife, Raisa, it was a marriage like none I've ever seen before. We talk rhetorically about marriage of two people becoming one.
Yeah.
They really had. And when she died, he just wasn't the same Gorbachev. And we still see him. I have I like Gorbachev a lot as a man. Putin, it's not my job to like him or dislike him. It's my job as a historian of Russia to analyze him in terms of Russian history and then try to provide political analysis of what he's doing today. What I have concluded, based on 45 years of study, and I'm a man almost without ideology. I'm not a Democrat or a Republican. Without ideology, is that my understanding of him is profoundly different from the American political establishment, which presents him as a demon. And it seems to me if we don't understand Putin in his own terms, then we have no way of checking whether our policy makes any sense. Maybe we're doing things that are leading to bad results because we don't understand his reaction. I'll just sum it up in one sentence. Maybe it's two. I don't know. I don't punctuate so well. The prevailing American view is that the entire Ukrainian crisis, the new Cold War, is because of Putin's aggression. You can read it every day in the papers. Russia's aggression, Putin's aggression. My analysis is that from day one, 1 year ago, Putin's policies have mainly been reactive. He's been reacting to what we did. And I will tell you, there are five people in this United States, some of them exceedingly famous, exceedingly well-known statespeople, who could have told Obama what Putin would do if Obama did X, Y, and Z. And Obama never talked to those people. So we've got a president who is uninformed about the most serious political issue of the time internationally, because there is no understanding of what Putin and Putinism are today in this world. And it's not about being a demon. It's about Russian history.
Next up, we go to Dennis in Philadelphia. Thanks for calling, Dennis, and welcome to the program. You're up with us.
Yes, good morning. You know, I have one comment. You know, it's really the situation here in Ukraine with Russia. And when you shine the spotlight on the situation with Israel, you know, the hypocrisy here is so thick, you can slice it with a knife. When Israel responds toward the Palestinians, right away the U.S. says Israel has a right to defend itself. When you look at the situation with Russia, now suddenly what Israel has a right to do, Russia doesn't have a right to do. Here we have a bunch of Nazis with the help of the U.S. The U.S. funded over $40 million the coup into Ukraine. And when Russia wants to defend the Russian people in the Ukraine, when Russia wants to get involved militarily in defending its borders, now suddenly Russia is called the aggressor, and they don't have a right to defend its borders and defend its people in the Ukraine.
Well, Stephen, it seems like there are a lot of people that somehow defend the Russian side. Your reaction?
Well, I think Dennis makes an interesting analogy, the situation regarding Israel and Palestine and Russia and Ukraine. He could have gone on to say, and I bet if he was still on the line, he'd just say he didn't have time to say it, that he's thought it, that when Israel was bombarding the Palestinian territories, and we were shown that on American TV, we had a debate in this country about whether what Israel was doing was inhumane. And some people said, no, Israel has to defend itself. Right. And other people said, no, you can't kill women and children arbitrarily like that. So we had a debate. And you and I and Dennis, we could make up our own mind. We had the information. But do Americans know that 5,000 people have died in the Donbass because of Kiev's war against the Donbass, which, by the way, unlike with Palestine and Israel, Donbass is part of Ukraine. It's killing its own citizens. 5,000 dead, 4,700.
Yep, and most of them civilians.
Well, you know, it's hard to break it down, but they're bombing civilian cities. And, of course, fighters in civilian cities hide in the city. I mean, I concede that. But let's just rough it out. Roughly 5,000 dead, 10,000 wounded, and 1 million displaced refugees. Is that story reported in the United States? Is it shown on TV? By the way, it is in Germany and in Europe. If we saw that story on TV, people would be horrified to see those men, women, and children dying in buildings in Ukraine, killed by a government we support. And so we'd be having a discussion. Is this right? Is this wrong? Are there two sides of the story? But there's a blackout on this story in the United States. And that's the problem. We don't, and I'm having it with you tonight. Thank you very much. But we're not having it regularly every day as we should. So I think the Israel, and there's one other footnote. Israel did not support the United States at the UN against Russia. That's interesting.
That is interesting.
One thing, relations between Putin's Russia and Israel are better than Jewish-Israeli-Russian relations have been ever, ever, ever in history.
Well, and I've got to say, though, with defense of Israel.
That. I mean, I don't make that the number one marker in international affairs, but it's significant.
But I've got to say, Stephen, had Hamas stopped bombing and sending rockets into Israel, Israel would not have attacked.
That may be absolutely true, but we're having that argument in the United States. But where is the same discussion? As Dennis pointed out, there seems to be a dual standard. Israel can do what it wants, and maybe rightly, but does Russia have a right to defend its ethnic kinfolk or not?
We go to Mike now in Norfolk, Virginia. Let's get you in here, Michael. Go ahead.
Hey, this keeps coming up about the current Ukrainian government being linked to the Nazis of World War II. Is this solid stuff?
Yes and no. Putin and his government, in the beginning, when the coup took place in February, said that a Nazi government had come to power. That was untrue. And the government in Kiev today, if you just count the guys and a couple women in the who hold the ministries, the portfolios, overwhelmingly, they are not ultra-right-wingers. However, there are very strong ultra-right nationalist movements in Ukraine who identify themselves with the fascist Ukrainian collaborators in World War II. They use their symbols, they sing their songs, they carry their portraits. So there is a neo-fascist movement in Ukraine. To my taste, it's playing too big of a role. It has its own fighting battalions and militias on the front lines. It has its own semi-stormtroopers stalking the streets of Kiev. And two or three of its leaders have been given governmental positions in the security forces, military and police. That's bad. I don't want anybody with neo-fascist attitudes anywhere near any government office anywhere in the world. And it's happened in Ukraine. They are a small faction, but from small things have grown large things. That's the lesson of the 20th century. Lenin's communists were a tiny, tiny party in February. And in October, November, they came to power. Hitler's party was tiny, tiny, tiny in Bavaria, and it came to power. If the United States, above all, is not concerned about that, something's wrong. And the State Department and the White House will not say a word about these neo-fascists that are running around the government that we supported. They are not the government, but they have influence, and they're playing a role. That's the long and the short of it. We can make of it what we will. I don't like it.
We seem to back strange people, Stephen. Look at ISIS. We created them, the Taliban. They were the Mujahideen in Afghanistan when the Soviets were there.
Let's take it back to Putin again. He gave a speech in Lost the Month. We're in December. I guess it was early November. There's an annual meeting where Putin meets with foreign correspondents at a meeting called Valdai in Russia. He gave a very long speech. It was hardly reported in this country. But the essence of his speech was that the United States goes around the world pursuing a policy of regime change, overthrowing governments. And what comes in the place of those governments are worse people.
Are worse.
And worse both for the world and for the citizens of that country. So, for example, is the government of Egypt today, which has imprisoned so many people, really worse than the Mubarak government?
Right. Or Gaddafi, Saddam Hussein.
I was about to say Gaddafi. Essentially, we assassinated. We were behind that. Tracked him on his cell phone and killed him. Is Libya today better off than it was when he was a leader? Better off for the people of Libya? And you could ask that question about Iraq. You can ask that question about Syria. And by the way, we're going to be asking that question if and when American troops actually leave Afghanistan, because the Taliban is going to take the country over again eventually.
Well, they're going to come right back. William, Stephen, we are out of time, but I want to thank you for being part of the program. Stephen Cohen, his website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Up next, investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe with some incredible stories for you.